Okay, now we're gonna start. So our three next speakers are Sergey Bratos. He's a research assistant professor at Dartmouth College. Next is Bax. She's a PhD student also at Dartmouth College. And to the right is Julian Bangert. He's a student at MIT. And they all specialize in finding machines where there shouldn't be any machines, and sometimes these machines turn out to be Turing complete. And they're now going to show us their latest work. Please give it up for Trusting Trust for Binary Toolchains.
Hello, it's great to be here. We're going to build on our previous year's talk, which some of you may have caught. If not, we'll catch you up. And I am Sergey, we're from Dartmouth. Julian was from Dartmouth as well, but he defected, traitor. Okay, so this is what we're going to talk about. Imagine, if you will, that we could make bugs disappear magically, for some definition of disappear and for some definition of bugs. Would we be able to build chains of trust that wouldn't suck so much as they do now? And we're going to explain why not, and why the standard practices of constructing chains of trust these days have to change before we can actually trust them. And if you want a tongue twister to go with this as a take home, bugless Babel breaks badly, right? Because this is going to be about the Tower of Babel and the problems that you get when you have things disagreeing on components of your trust chain, disagreeing on dialects. And we're going to show you some case studies. In particular, L-signing and a bit about MacO. And then we're going to show you how the Linux kernel disagrees with the Linux loader about what is where in the loaded image. Isn't that fun? I'll start with theory and then hand it to Bex, and then she'll hand it to Julian. So 1984, Ken Thompson, in his famous Reflections on Trusting Trust, almost 30 years ago, you know, 29, but what's an off by one, came up with this maxim that you can't trust code that you didn't completely write yourself. And he planted a bug in the compiler, and the compiler, having compiled whatever was built with that trust chain, propagated the backdoor into everything and compiled. And so you shouldn't really trust your compiler. He went on to predict the future, and by now, everything that he predicted came true, including well-placed microcode bugs. And really, these days, when you look at software, you wonder, well, which software doesn't have planted bugs, right? Certain organizations have something to do with it, but honestly, 30 years ago, I never imagine that I would ever encounter a deliberately planted bug, and yet here we go. But what if we could wave a magic wand and make it all go away? What if we could completely trust the author? And what if the author could completely trust him or herself to have the code do exactly what the author intended? Would we solve trusting trust then? And the answer is, hell no. And the reason is that trust chains are built up and up and up, and all of the components of those trust chains must talk to each other and agree on what they're saying and agree on what they're interpreting. This is what software engineering pretty much looks today, right? If you need the narrative, biblical narrative reminder, people decided to build a tower to reach the sky. The powers that be did not like that, so they made the dialects of the builders diverge, and suddenly, if one builder asked for a rope, he was instead handed a saw, or somebody said, "Give me a saw," and the other person heard, "Well, your father is a donkey." And as you can imagine, the construction didn't go well afterwards. So if we're to explain it with cats, right, the components of the trust chain must speak precisely the same dialect of the inputs, or else you are going to have, we're going to call this the Babel cat, you know, the ceiling cat, which is over your moral health. The Babel cat is in your trust chains. Well, let's make this a bit more theoretical before we get to the practice. What is a chain of trust? A chain of trust is really a chain of execution environments of increasing power. You start at boot, you execute some code, you load your OS, you execute some code, and eventually you want to get to the executable that you want to run, construct a process out of it, and run it, and hopefully throughout that entire process, no unexpected computation, otherwise known as pwnage, occurs. It's the same code, it's the same bytes that are being interpreted by a chain of parsers and handled by a chain of loaders. And so the meaning of those bytes has to be completely agreed upon between all of those trust links. Now, when I say trust, what exactly do I mean, right? How do we trust, why do we trust things, why do we trust bytes to run them? Well, you know, there are two approaches to this. You can't analyze Turing complete binary code, which is, of course, what you compile down to. And so instead, you sign it. You trust the process of your developers, you trust their good intentions, you trust their SecOps, and so on. And so you get this frozen bit of code, and you hope that it will be immutable. Or there is another way. You can actually check the code, do static analysis of it, convince yourself that the execution of it will be exactly as intended. You can do that as well. And then you can trust it because you've analyzed it. It doesn't work with general code, no matter what antivirus vendors would tell you, how many times a day they solve the halting problem, you know. So let's see which kinds of trust are there in trust chain. And the answer is both, right? You freeze some bits in your binary, but you also want to do composition. You also want to have libraries, loadable modules, combine signed code from different sources. So in the end, your trusted binary ends up being this kind of a sausage thing with some bits frozen and hard, and some other bits telling you where in that sausage the trusted bits, the frozen bits are. So enter stage right, or stage left, tables. Tables that describe where the signed pieces are and where those signatures are. And you know, a table is a table, right? A table is very simple. Stuff it full of offsets, right? Or you can even put some data in there about how you relocate the code, how to patch the code. It's still a table, right? So that makes ASLR possible. But really, if you do composition, you can't avoid having tables. But in fact, any input is a program. And any table is a program as well. So what happens there is, here's your table, you know, a periodic table. This is probably the top of my graphics abilities, so please bear with me. Right? So it's a table that describes the elements of the sausage, of the trusted sausage, of the composition of the binary file. Well, I could be saying ABI, application binary interface. But what happens is, there are pieces of code. You can think of them as pieces of logic that are baked into the processor. Well, except they aren't. They are in your loader. They are in your kernel. They are in your RTLD. And these pieces of code consume the tables, just as your processor consumes its inputs. Now, hopefully, that logic is simple enough so that your computation doesn't get run away. But tables drive computation just like anything else. Tables are, in fact, something of a bytecode. If you think of how you compute those offsets and locate the signed pieces and their signatures, well, you're doing arithmetic. You're doing branches. You're doing loops. All of these things are known, if you are unlucky, to give you a Turing machine. And Bex showed such a Turing machine on relocation tables last CCC. So, in fact, any input is a program. That's just a matter of principle. This is what we stand on. Any sufficiently complex input data is indistinguishable from bytecode driving some virtual machine. Oh, if you see that, do this. If you see this, do that. That's how you write a VM. A parser code for any sufficiently complex input is indistinguishable from a virtual machine running its inputs. So what happens there is that what you think of as input validation, you know, is this table valid, is actually something of runtime verification of the bytecode that are your tables, that are your metadata. So what can go wrong? And of course, your parser may be buggy. Your parser may overflow memory, corrupt it, and then some other piece of logic will take the corruption and run with it, and run away with it, and with your trustworthy system as such. But the input can be completely well-formed. But as a matter of software engineering, so complex that there is no predicting what it would do. Halting problem, Turing completeness. It turns out that even the relocations and symbols, tables, have that. Or the input could be seen differently, the Babel effect, and different pieces of the trust chain would disagree, and the trust will be lost. And we'll show you both examples. And so just, by the way, these are the three cats of the apocalypse. Right? You know. And we're going to be looking at the two cats, who get the gold star and the red star, the well-formed input that's so complex and the parser differentials. And so, you know, you think you're doing software engineering, you think you're doing code reuse and things like that. What you're in fact doing is you're getting the Turing cat out of the bag, right? And the cat then turns out to be quite an impressive cat. You know, medieval bestiary writers knew their cats. So here is your runtime after boot. Boot process has the same issues. But here is the original Ken Thompson's planted bug. It was on the compiler. Then, of course, comes the linker, and then the loader, and then the dynamic linker, if you are for code reuse, and the relocator, the dynamic relocator machine. And then, of course, there is memory management and page faults and double faults if you're unlucky, and exception handling. So this is sort of your process from birth to grave. And just to remind you, we found that these pieces that have the gold stars are actually Turing complete on their inputs. So if you feed them crafted tables that are complex enough, you can actually compile any computation, any program, into those crafted tables. The favorite of, especially favorite of mine, is the weird machine. In the page fault handling logic, because page fault handling logic actually not only reads from memory and is triggered by a read from memory or a write, it also writes to memory itself. So you can close the loop and keep your processor doing whatever it's doing to handle a page fault, alternating between the page fault and the double fault as a tick of the machine. And while no execution instruction is getting fetched successfully, you're continually getting the illegal instruction and the page fault. You can still compute anything you like and write interesting patterns into memory. Julian, take a bow. Julian wrote a compiler for that sort of thing. Dynamic relocator, right? Bex, take a bow. Bex implemented the language called BrainFuck and the compiler into that language, which is known to be Turing complete. You know, some academic has had an unerring sense of taste, probably. term, what can you do? The relocating engine that builds up your program in memory is actually Turing complete, can be convinced to compute anything. Here's a new thing that we're going to show you. The RTLD and the loader can be made to disagree about what is in the program. They can see completely different pictures of memory that they are constructing or have constructed for the runtime. And that's a second kind of cat of doom. We finally wrote this up. I mean, first we gave it at hacker conferences because hacker conferences are just about the only place where this kind of thing is appreciated. Because why would you really want to know what's in your machine and how to, you know, what sorts of extra logic can you squeeze out of it when, you know, you can solve much more interesting problems such as how to have graphs that look like Anyhow, so Wood. Finally, we published those papers in Wood after having been rejected from some high and mighty other venues. And there will be more coming. So with this in mind, tables are programs. They run on the pieces of logic that interpret them. So when you are validating your inputs, I mean, God forbid you sanitize your inputs. This is an anti-pattern. This is absolutely the worst thing you can do. You know, the idea that, oh, there are bad things in the input, but you can suppress them by checking for them piecemeal. Oh, this is just pwned. This is wrong. This is pwned. But validation is actually the same as verification because that data causes computation. And you don't think of it that way. You don't think of it as program verification. You know, there have been talks here about formal analysis, but in fact it is. And the validation of tables is in fact static analysis of the computation that they induce. And even in the absence of bugs, you can have rather complex analysis or impossible analysis to perform so that you will be trusting your tables when they shouldn't be trusted. And you will be solving the antivirus vendor's halting problem when you are, the result is somewhat predictable. So with that, let's look at the specifics of the machines that execute tables. There we go. So with this little hiccup.
I turn it over to Beck.
I have a microphone.
Oh, you have a microphone, excellent. Go ahead.
Now we can talk at the same time.
What prepared students?
Code signing is definitely being worked into the trust train more and more, and we're seeing it and say, in certain environments, they're becoming walled gardens. But we're also seeing it popping up more and more in open source Linux for kernel modules, driver signing in Windows, et cetera. And it's It's being used to provide trust evidence in that this particular binary is not only has some sort of integrity and it hasn't been changed since, you know, signed, since the developer distributed, handed it to you, but we also are able to have some sort of attribution so that this binary really came from these people. And it's, you know, those are two good things to know about a given binary. It's easy to implement poorly because code signing is not just an algorithm. It's not just finding the right way to hash, et cetera. It's a lifestyle. There's so many components involved in code signing, and to have it done well and to really be able to have a good amount of trust evidence from code signing, you know, something verifying, we need to maintain, we have to have proper key management. And there's other things. The program that is loaded in memory that we really want to know is trustful, trustworthy, is not the same as the one on disk because we like to write things that are portable to different architectures or randomizable to help with other types of attacks. And really, the program that's in memory is merely influenced by that which is on disk. And then so we have to ask the question, does code signing really give us what we want it to give us, that this which was handed to us is what will be running and we are feeling trust, we feel like we could trust it because we know who gave it to us and we know there's some sort of integrity to the binary. But there's many machines involved in verification of a particular binary in code signing. We have to worry about parsers, interpreters, slash translators, validators. There's all these things that we bring together, and we end up with some sort of like Rube Goldberg machine that it's not even that. It's different components of the machine of a code sign will actually put together pieces of data that to hand to the next one, and so there's many different components working together, and we have to think about how this really fits and how we can trust the different components and trust a composition because different security doesn't compose particularly well. We have to think about it. So when we are considering code signing, there's a bunch of questions that come to my mind when I want to look at a system. Are these machines that implement code signing correctly implemented, bug-free? But even if they're not, do we understand what these different machines are capable of? We've shown that metadata for elves in last year's talk that I did is capable of running Turing complete or pushing Turing complete processes, making the loader do something that we really don't expect necessarily. If we have two different machines operating on the same data, do they agree on how it's parsed and how to interpret it? Do the tables that we are basing these computations off of, are they correct? Are they complete? Do they really portray what we need to know in order to trust the code, the signature? Can we trust the transformations that are done to the process once it's loaded into memory after we do this sort of static analysis and look at these frozen bits and pray that these like squishy bits that we can change are change it in the right way? And then another big question is enforcement, which I won't cover at all because that's a whole thing. How do we want to enforce this validation? I looked at a bunch of different ELF code signing mechanisms, many that seem kind of obsolete, but this is a case study, and I hope we can learn a little from what has been done. And in thinking about the code signing in ELF, we have a bunch of components, machines that are working together. We have parsers that parse out the signature metadata and other data in the ELF file. We have interpreters and translators, such ones that maybe may look at the binary and produce a bunch of hashes based on that so that we can start looking at signatures. And we have validator machines, part of this whole code signing process, that look at certificates and signatures, hashes. There's a lot working together in this Rube Goldberg machine. So I started looking at different implementations of code signing in ELF for both executable userland binaries and kernel modules. And I must say, they have very creative names For their code signing, I actually had trouble telling a lot of them apart and figuring out which were different. And a lot of these were actually written in 2003, 2004, 2005, are pretty obsolete. I started seeing a resurgence of work, and especially more in the kernel module area. But yeah, so a lot of what I looked at is kind of obsolete, but is interesting. So questions that I asked before, I'm going to revisit right now. Are the machines involved with this code signing correctly implemented? In Marco, there's actually XML embedded into their code signature. And we know how easy it is to parse XML and how well implemented XML parsers are. Certificates and anything that's signed is often encoded in ASN1 BER format, and those are easy to parse, and everyone will agree on the correct parsing of a particular certificate. There is no problem there. In ELF, I saw that everything was written in either C. Actually, everything but one thing I looked at was written in C. There was one thing written in C++, and those are safe languages. I'm sure there won't be any other bugs that are exploitable because of that. How powerful are our machines that take part in this signing process? I think there's a work that we need to really do in this, and just thinking about it at our old work, things that just look like tables, like relocation metadata, we found to drive like this unexpected computation. So if we're able, we want to make sure we understand what the components of code signing are able to do, because this is old work in putting backdoor into ping that drops a root shell, and on the top it's ELF, and the green is data that was added to the file, and there was a couple other changes made to the file. Bottom is the same exact backdoor in Mako, and the red bytes, those were changed. No other changes, nothing else was added or removed from the file. So it's actually, I would argue that hiding computation and metadata, it can be, you can see it, but it also can be hard to see, especially if two different interpreters parse the metadata differently. And so that's something we need to be careful with in code signing. So I also started looking, this is code from various different code signing for ELF implementations I looked at. So the question is, can what we're looking at, can the metadata that we're looking at that's involved with the signing, the tables that are driving our computation, how much do we need to trust them? In this particular example, this is from bSign. It's doing a lot of checks, but I love this comment right here. It's like, I don't recall why we need to check more than just the ELF header. And the author goes on to check different headers as well. But the interesting part is the author thought, I could stop here and I think we'll be okay. But there's more to be considered in how much data to check. And I almost see this as a red flag. We need to think a little more while we're developing code signing if we want to actually be able to trust what comes from it. In parser differentials, so having two different dialects, two different parsers for the same data. So in these particular ASN1 BR encoded messages for signing, can be a little difficult to decode. ELF has multiple ways to interpret it, and Julian will actually get into this, so I will just say that there's multiple ways to load an ELF. And there's multiple ways to locate a section. So if your signature is in a single section, you need to be sure that everything that's looking up this signature is looking up the same signature, because it's possible to put in two sections with the same name. And this particular piece of code was a proposed patch to the kernel for module signing, and it's just looking for the signature section by looping through all the segments and stopping at the first one that has the correct name and breaking out of that loop. And I've seen other implementations that will loop through all the signature sections and remember the last one. And we need to be careful with these differentials. We need to think about completeness and correctness of the code signing. This is an example from ELF GPG and these comments. Only look at the interesting section. So it's just, if it has, let's see, if it's of type null, then perhaps it won't get loaded. And then let's see, skip over the signed sections. Okay, well, I can name other sections. I can give other sections the same name. So is there something else in the code signing that's preventing me from inserting new sections? So there's a larger picture we need to look at. And with more with correctness and completeness, signing the signatures, who watches the watchers? But these signatures are still loaded in memory. And this particular example from ElfSign, it just assumes that the last segment in the file is the signature, and it won't try to hash that and for the signature at all. So does that leave us an interesting way to sneak in more data that gets mapped to memory? So a little bit about Mako code signing. I'm so lucky to get our graphic designer to draw up a nice sketch up what a code blob looked like that are embedded at the end of Mako files that use code signing. It's slightly complicated, so I simplified it a lot to give you an idea of all the parsers and interpreters that are required for this. So in Mako code signing blob, there's a bunch of metadata. There are something called internal requirements, which is actually encoded in this bytecode. And what I wrote here is a text representation of it, of what might need to sign the interpreter if it's, say, a Perl program, and what needs to sign the certificate. But these are encoded into a bytecode with strings and et cetera. And it's a hand-rolled interpreter. Entitlements are in XML, and I noted that before, that we all perfectly know how to parse XML, and there's no problems with that. But yeah, and so there's also a bunch of hashes, and so those need to be parsed out. That's another table. And finally, a nice encoding of a signature. So there's all these different components that are working together that we must trust, and yet there's so much room for parsers that disagree. So to take away from what I'm thinking is, you can't trust code that you did not totally create yourself. But you also have to think the environment in which loaded it, all everything that's signing, all the relocations, and everything, because that which is on disk doesn't match that that's loaded in memory. So the corollary is you cannot trust code that you did not totally load yourself. And with that, I will let Julian continue.
Okay, hello. And now for the third part of the talk, we bring out the third cat of the apocalypse, which takes the form of an elephant that's stomping all over our trust chains and also our trusted China. And that elephant are parser differentials. Parser differentials break chains of trust. Chains of trust are multiple elements that implicitly trust each other. Now if various parts in the binary toolchain see different things, that implicit trust is violated and can be made to interpret the same data differently than the trust is implicitly violated. Historically, there have been issues such as with X509 SSL certificates, as Bex already mentioned, that I might get the certificate authority to see a subdomain of julianbanger.com being signed, but when your browser looks at the same certificate, it actually sees a certificate for paypal.com, and then you might run into an issue. More recently, there have been issues with Android's code signing, Saurix Android Master Key vulnerability, where you have two separate parsers for the same zip file that contains an Android application, one of them implemented in C, one of them implemented in Java. And the designers of Java did not believe in unsigned integers, whereas the C implementation uses unsigned integers. Then suddenly, well, the signature matches when it's installed, but hey, you can run something completely differently when you're actually executing the thing. The same also happens on Apple iOS. As the evaders demonstrated in the iOS 6 jailbreak, different components within a toolchain can see the same binary differently, and therefore you can sneak past the code signature scheme in that case. And as Bex demonstrated, the same happens for the Linux kernel with their kernel modes module signing schemes. And what I'm going to talk about is it also happens in user space. We found a parser differential between the in-kernel parser as part of the exec system call and the user space dynamic loader that handles things like actually setting up your address space and loading in all the various dynamic libraries you have. And little quick question into the audience. How many elf passes are there involved in your typical program execution? Does anyone know? Indeed. Well, there tends to be at least two. Depending on what your system are, you might have a lot more. There's all sorts of things from kernel modules onwards. But the two that we're going to focus on is the elf loader in the kernel in bin format elf, and the userland LDSO loader that's part of the GNU C library. And in order for there to be any sort of trust and in any code signing schemes, all of these elf parsers have to see the same view of the sections and the segments and have to interpret all of the metadata that they rely on to enforce their trust exactly the same way. And now when these two parsers are implemented by two totally separate entities and don't share any code or don't share any formal grammar that can be used to prove their equivalence, it's pretty unlikely that they'll actually see the same information in that sequence, in just the right sequence of bytes. The particular example we're going to look at today is about the ELF program header table, in particular the ptload entries. Ptload is there to map a range of bytes from the ELF file into the address range of the program you just want to execute. It describes the various code and data segments in your program. Internally, the implementation of the exec system call just converts every ptload entry in that table into a memmap system call. That's what the evaders noted as part of their iOS jailbreak, that a memory map at a fixed address replaces any previous mappings at that particular address, which means they could remap an address that had already been validated, and certain other parts of the tool chain would just look for the first entry mapping that address, whereas really the kernel would use the last one. Which is, if you're looking at the parsers, not immediately obvious, because they actually aren't parsers for a table. They're automata that are executing on the data that's present in that table. And unless you're thinking of them as automata that have mutable state, it's unlikely that you'll catch all of these bugs, because the spec note mentions nowhere that the order of these entries is in fact important. In order to drive home the point, this is the actual part of the Linux kernel source code as of 3.4 that actually processes ptload entries in an ELF file's program header table. And this does not really look like a parser. There is no grammar, there's no BNF. There's just randomly casting around pointers and adding stuff. And a particularly interesting bit that I'll get to in a second is this line here. So the typical layout of an ELF file is that there's the ELF header that Bex already described, followed immediately by this program header table. And the program header table describes how the ELF file is supposed to be mapped into memory. And in order to execute a program, the kernel first reads this program header table into a buffer it allocates, performs one memory map for each ptload with the awesome parsing source code that we just saw. It then finds out if that program is dynamically linked, which nowadays is true for just about any binary, and loads the dynamic loader from the file name present in a special section. And then in order to tell the dynamic loader from where it's supposed to start parsing the ELF file, it has to give it the virtual address where the program header table resides. Because the Linux kernel has access to the executable file as a file. It can read the bytes. Whereas the user space loader is actually already mapped into the address space, and therefore can only access the virtual addresses. So the kernel has to bootstrap the translation between virtual addresses and ranges of bytes. And it does that by looking at the address where the first ptload was mapped and adding the file offset in bytes to that address. And it then writes it into a special data structure called an aux vector, where the user space loader will then look and begin parsing the ELF file. If the ELF parse had been written in a, say, more type-safe language, that would probably not have compiled, because it turns out you're adding a file offset to a memory pointer. In the usual case of any binary that comes out of GCC or Clang or whatever your compiler is, which always places the program header table in the first segment, that works perfectly fine, because really the mapping is perfectly linear, so you can add file offsets to virtual memory addresses as you please. However, if someone were to be a little less nice and a little less orderly and place the program header table somewhere else in memory, the kernel, which is reading it as a sequence of bytes, oh well, so the offset in the file is a bit larger, so we have to seek to a different sector on disk, no big deal. However, then when it adds that, suddenly the pointer in the aux vector is pointing to some other garbage. If you craft things just right, and you can, because if you're controlling the program header table, you can point, you can map arbitrary memory at arbitrary addresses, really something else will be interpreted as a program header table that no other tool will see as such. Which, of course, is quite a nice thing if you want to hide a binary or hide some other things from reverse engineers who tend to poke into your code. So if instead of having the normal layout, you have this particular layout where you place the program header table at the very end of the file, and you craft things just right, and you make the memory layout just right, you can make sure that the user space loader will actually see a program header table somewhere in the middle of the data segment that could have previously been some unused padding. Or you could even make a new segment with it if you so want to. Or if you have one of Bex's code signing schemes, you could point it to the middle of a PGP signature. And in order to demonstrate this, we cooked up a little demo. A fun fact for the side that we're going to use in this is that in Linux, you can actually execute a library. I don't really understand why, but if you have a Linux terminal open, you can try executing libc, and it'll actually print out its compile date and a few options and give you an email address where you can bug them about bugs. And if you do that, well, it goes through the normal kernel parser for exec, and then pass off control to the separate parser that's also living as part of libc for the user space loader. However, when you're loading that same file as a shared library from another process, the kernel never gets to touch it. The kernel exec never runs for shared library. And it will only be loaded by LDSO, which in this case will get a consistent view, which will be completely different. And now I hope that the demo works properly.
Demo gods.
Pray.
Demo gods.
Yay! OK, our sample is we first have our shared library. It's relatively straightforward. It just calls another function. I'll explain in a second why. And that other function normally comes from a file libgood.c, which does nothing but print hello world. And in order to demonstrate this awesome shared library that, by the way, we're selling licenses for something that I can't disclose except under NDA. And apparently I also can't type anymore. We just have a little sample program that will invoke that function. And if we do it, indeed, everything is well. We have hello world. We can even trace the execution. We see, OK, it's loading libgood.so and it's loading libpoc.so. Everything is perfectly fine. However, now when we're executing libpoc.so directly, we tend to get this nasty little bugger, which is a shell, which people might not have expected because maybe your device isn't supposed to have a shell binary running on it, but some nasty engineer compiled stuff in a weird way. And actually, if you're running on Debian, you again might want to figure out what is going on. And you see, OK, what libraries are linked into libpoc.so? Oh, it's just libgood. And seeing that you can then load everything up in Pro, and you'll see, OK, it's just going into libgood. And let's look into libgood. Oh, it doesn't even mention a bin shell. So how the hell does it fork something? Well, it turns out that because it uses these crafted p headers and the source code for the ELF manipulation is available in the good Pastor Manuel Lefroig's International Journal of POC, or get the fuck out, which is available at your local Samistat retailer. You'll notice that, in fact, and you can do this if you actually take the pain of debugging the thing and then looking at proc maps, it will actually link to libevil.so, which contains the shared drop. Because the user space loader sees a completely different program header table, from which on I can point it to a completely different dynamic table, which allows me to completely manipulate what the binary is doing. If I wouldn't want to load another shared library, I could also use the tricks that Bex has demonstrated and many other people say, escape, slow create, to completely rewrite my binary at runtime and just embed the code directly into it. But for the purposes of having a clear and understandable POC, loading a different shared library is just as easily. As a side note, if you happen to run this on a more sane system and not Debian, LDD will actually, say on Arch, LDD will actually tell you that it's linking towards libevil. Because as some side effect of, I think, an SA Linux implementation, LDD actually invokes the user space loader as an executable. which is an alternative way of executing a binary without having access to an exec system call, which means that the debugging tool actually does not debug what would happen normally. So in this way, you can quietly hide code in a shared library. And feel free to play around with it. There's a few other, I'm sure there's many other parsing ambiguities in ELF. And with that, I'll hand it back to Sue. And yes, as I mentioned, the idea of loading a shared library is really just a trick for the POC. If you want to, you can use the various tables that you now have control over and that you now have successfully hidden from all those pesky IDA-wielding eyes to rewrite your binary at will.
Well, so just to cover the last point, we've used relocation entries to completely rewrite an image that is loading, and whatever you think you're getting is absolutely not what is in your runtime. However, relocation entries are powerful. They are there for editing the loaded code, for patching the loaded code, for rewriting addresses. So that's cheating, right? How about just symbols? Just dynamic symbols. Just a dynamic symbol table. Turns out with this trick we can. Because I can pretend that all of your program is the global offset table. A global offset table is something that the dynamic linker writes into, because this is where the address of the resolved function by name, say you want print, okay, your first jump will be into the a stub through the global offset table, which will be pointing at that stub, and then the stub will bring you into the dynamic loader, which will resolve print by name, load the library, well, you know, libc, and then it will overwrite the global offset table entry pointing there. And so your next jump, your next call to print, will go straight to the library, to the resolved symbol. So now I can pretend that my entire program is got. And yes, that will take rather large symbol tables, but we can fingerprint paint memory this way. So to conclude, chains of trust are something that we absolutely want to have. All of those little steps, little links in them, such as loading, signing, checking signatures, anything that involves finding the pieces that we trust, and the pieces that we trust other pieces to go by and contain evidence, say cryptographic evidence, that they have not changed, they have not been tampered with, all of those steps are as important computationally as the original development process. And even though you may have no bugs there whatsoever, you will nevertheless likely have disagreements between the links in the chain of trust, and you will likely also have rather powerful software engineering hacks like relocation that in fact can rewrite your program and will deprive you of the ability to apply the first kind of trust. I analyzed it, therefore I trust it. And of course you can start signing everything, but composition is the soul of software engineering. So you will at some point face the necessity to combine things, programs out of pieces of code. So let's come back to trusting trust, reflections on trusting trust. Even though there may be no bugs, it was never all about the bugs. Sure, memory corruption is fun. Sure, shell code is lovely, but parser differentials are equally important. Agreement in the dialects of the parsers that are the parsers in the chain of trust is equally important. Complex data formats that don't allow you to check things for the first order of trust. I have analyzed it fully. I know what kind of a program that table is. They kill trust. Diversion of dialects kills trust. There can be no chain of trust in Babel. You are, you know, all your cats building up that Babel Tower, and yeah, not a good software engineering practice. So what could we do? We should be, I mean, what do we want? Chains of trust. When do we want them? Now, right? What do we want? Simple formats. Simple formats that take away the computational power from the tables so that you can actually statically analyze the computation that they will cause. Squeeze complexity out of data. We want simple formats. Now, starting with a boot, you know, we've looked at the top of the trust chain. What about the beginning, the bottom? UEFI, how simple is that? Okay. Software package formats. Zipped, crypto. I mean, Android master key bugs were just brilliant. You know, oh, you shouldn't roll your own crypto. Therefore, we will use the Java crypto library because that's great code. One problem. The installer is a Linux installer, and what it sees is not what the Java crypto verifier sees. And with my best impression of Agent Smith, you know, what good is a signature, Mr. Anderson, if you can't even see the document? But it goes deeper than that. It's all about computation. It's all about input being programs and tables being programs in particular. So you have to hobble the power that these can induce in your code. So we have a few modest engineering proposals. One of them is called ELFBAC. You will see the TR. We will be releasing code eventually next year. Julian is the main developer. And that thing actually breaks Bex's weird machine because it deprives the relocator automaton of some of the implicit flows that she has used. And it breaks other techniques as well. And of course, everyone wants new hardware that would contain our parsers and not allow them to run away with the rest of your program, even if they contain a bug. But as we have seen, bugs are not a necessity for getting pwned. It's a little disagreement between what the dialects of your input, the parsers de facto accept. They will not see the same thing. And so we're going to hold an academic workshop in this. The inventors of the language theoretic approach to security, which is what I've been sneaking in during the entire introduction, is finally we're going to have a workshop where these topics will be considered. And it's co-located with the IEEE Security and Privacy Symposium 2014. May 18th, you will find the CFP and the program committee lists and instructions and whatnot at this URL. It will be dedicated to the memory of Len Sassaman, who, together with his wife Meredith Patterson, invented the topic. So consider submitting case studies, theory papers, exploits that use these ideas of language theoretic security, parser differentials, and weird machines that run away on their input by being way too powerful and by forcing the defender to solve the halting problem, which of course cannot be solved. With that, I thank you.
Wow. We ended on time.
It's great to be here.
Okay. So we have very little time for Q&A. So if you have a question, please line up at one of the 8 microphones that we have in this room. If you leave, please take your trash with you. And please put all the bottles in one of the crates located at each exit. So do we have a question? So we have a question from the internet.
So the internet would like to know if you could implement relocation without a Turing complete semantics.
I have not understood. Oh,
please repeat the question.
So the question is, can you implement relocation without Turing complete semantics?
Yes, and you should. Moreover, you should implement linking and every other step in the ABI without Turing completeness. Because if you actually do have Turing completeness accidentally or by design, you are completely depriving yourself of the ability to check what the actual result would look like other than by running it, otherwise known as halting. This will probably be a part of Bex's thesis. this is a very good question. We see Turing completeness being shoved everywhere. In order to download a file from Dropbox, I need to run JavaScript, right? What is so Turing complete about downloading a file? Why do I need to run JavaScript? Daily to interact, to shove numbers to a website and get numbers out of the website, I need to run JavaScript. Why? And HTML5 together with CSS, look up excellent works by Mario Heiderich, that thing can be tricked into Turing completeness via things like autofilling of forms. And it's been actually proven Turing complete I'm failing on the reference, but it is in our paper, which you'll find on the LangSec site. So we are surrounded by completely useless and unnecessary Turing completeness, and that's just it's just there to break trust. It's just there to empower the attacker. Computation, the minimum privilege principle, the least privilege principle, should be that computation also is a privilege, and it is a privilege given to attacker. So Turing completeness where it doesn't belong, Turing completeness at communication boundaries in particular, where untrusted data arrives, is a really, really bad idea. If you haven't yet, I encourage you to watch the talk by Meredith Patterson, The Science of Insecurity, at 28C3. Again, you will find links on langsec.org site. Have I responded?
Okay. Yeah, so the gentleman at microphone number one, please. Very quick.
I'm not sure if I understood this correctly. The tables that are used to rewrite the signed code, are they part of the, or not part of the code signing process?
Many signing schemes do not sign metadata.
Hooray.
Right? The answer is, we've been asked by, Bex has done this for ELF, but PE is a cousin of ELF with all sorts of interesting properties. MechO is a cousin of ELF, and MechO actually does relocation with bytecode, a special dedicated bytecode, not just C structures with offsets as ELF, with offsets and types and pointers to symbols. That is actual bytecode. The virtual machine is included for it. And guess what? Of course, it's Turing complete as well.
Okay. Our time is up. Thank you very much.